Hello, everybody. Hey, hope everyone has a Yirmiyahu chapter 1. Yirmiyahu Perek Aleph. Okay. All right, so our Rav Torah this Shabbos means that we are no longer, for the rest of the year, going to connect the Haftorah to the Torah reading, per se, in theme. The Haftorahs from here on until Rosh Hashanah are connected to the time of year. Okay? But insofar as Parshas Pinchas still does have a thematic Haftorah, because in some years, Parshas Pinchas is read before Shiva Sarva Tammuz, and as such, is not a 3 weeks Haftorah. That will only happen when Matos and Maaseh are read separately. That sometimes happens in a leap year. Even in some leap years, we read them together, right? So when Matos and Maaseh are read separately, you can just look at the calendar and see and check this out. Pinchas will be before the 3 weeks, and therefore is not going to be one of the 3 weeks Haftorahs. Okay, Matos would be the first, Maaseh would be the second, and then Devarim is the third. But when Matos and Maaseh are together, then Pinchas is the first, Matos Maaseh is the second, and then Devarim. Okay, so Pinchas' Haftorah is what we did last week. But I would like to connect Pinchas to Yirmiyahu in the following way. Is that there's an inordinate amount of Nevi'im and Tanakh who happen to be Kohanim. In fact, there's a medrash you may know from a Gemara in Maseches Megillah. The medrash also appears in many different forms in different places in Chazal. That says that Rochav and Yehoshua got married, right? Yehoshua married the woman that helped them in the conquest of Jericho. And Rochav and Yehoshua had only daughters, right? We derive that from a pasuk in Divrei Yamim. And one of those daughters married a Kohen, and descended from that daughter are, in the Gemara in Megillah, it says seven Kohanim, who were Nevi'im, and another Medrash that's brought down in the Alkot Shimoni, the Alkot Shimoni's version, has eight Kohanim. Who's the extra Kohen? Is Yechezkel. Okay, the Gemara's list includes Yirmiyahu, but not Yechezkel. The Alkut Shimoni's list of eight includes Yechezkel. It would appear that Radak would follow that second opinion, since the Radak says that Yechezkel was Yirmiyahu's son. Okay? That means that according to that opinion, if Yirmiyahu was descended from Rochav and Yehoshua, Yechezkel was too. Right? And should be listed in that group. Okay, but be it as it may, all those Nevi'im, Yehoyada, Zechariah, Yirmiyahu, Yechezkel, stands to reason that a Kohen would be a Navi because his job is to be close to God, is to contemplate, is to be close to the Shekhinah. So the Nevuah waves that emanate from the Beis HaMikdash are very likely to rest on a Kohen. Okay, now what does it have to do with Pinchas? Because according to Chazal, Pinchas was Eliyahu, right? So in the Torah reading, it says that Pinchas was very zealous for God, Kanoes Kinosi. And in the Haftorah, that would have been this week's Haftorah if it were not part of the 3 weeks. In the Haftorah, we read about Eliyahu being of similar mindset. He says, Kano Kanesi Lashem. Okay? So Pinchas and Eliyahu are not only identified in terms of their frame of mind, but Chazal actually say that Pinchas is Eliyahu. It's a Gemara in Bava Metzia, Daf Kuf Yud Dalet, that says that Eliyahu took holding onto a dead body to bury him, and someone said, Eliyahu, aren't you a Kohen? Right? Okay, so Tosfos discusses Eliyahu's Kohanic status. And to be sure, there are other Midrashim that claim that Eliyahu was from other Shvatim, from Shevet Gad, possibly from Shevet Binyamin. Okay, I believe scattered throughout Chazal are six different opinions of what Shevet Eliyahu Anabi was from. It's called Eliyahu Agiladi, right? Gilad is Menashe. Okay, be that as it may, so Eliyahu as Pinchas is just this, the same, putting forth the same idea of the someone who is a Kohen is more likely to be inspired by the waves of Nevuah near where he works. Now, Yirmiyahu was a Kohen, and Kohanim at that time worked in the Beis HaMikdash. We're told, take a look at the beginning of the Sefer, Divrei Yirmiyahu ben Chilkiyahu min HaKohanim asher ba'anatot be'eretz Binyamin. So, Yirmiyahu is the son of a very Kohanic name, Chilkiyahu, the Chelek of Hashem. It just so happens that at the time of Yirmiyahu, the name of the Kohen Gadol was Chilkiyahu. Now, there's something called the conservation of names in Chazal, where, well, if the name of Chilkiyahu was the Kohen Gadol at the time, and Yirmiyahu's father was Chilkiyahu, it must be the same person. Okay? The evidence in this first pasuk itself might draw us to another conclusion because he is from the place called Anatot. Anybody remember what Anatot was? Remember that from where we did this before? I think in Parsha Shmos, in deference to our Sephardic brethren, because this is the Haftorah of Parshas Shmos. Ashkenazim for Shmos read about Yeshayahu's description of what's going to happen to Egypt in the future. Sephardim choose rather not to concentrate on the Egyptian/Israelite relationship as nations, but with the personal experience of Moshe at the burning bush, connecting it to our Haftorah right here. In fairness to the Ashkenazim, they might say, why should we read this as Haftorah? It's already a Haftorah. To which the Sephardim might respond, so what? There are a few other cases where we read the same Haftorah twice a year. Okay, so Kohanim, Sephardim do read this as the Haftorah for the Shabbos. But the evidence from his hailing from a place called Anatot, you see Anatot here? Right? Anatot was a city of banished Kohanim. Okay? How do I know that? Because if you recall, when Eli allowed his sons to continue their horrific trespasses, that God gave a prophecy to Shmuel as a child, what terrible things would happen to their descendants, right? And one of those things is that the descendants of Eli will never serve God in his permanent house. In fact, the sons of Eli were about to lose the house that they had now, which was Shiloh. About to lose it to the Philistines, who would destroy Shiloh and take the Aram. Okay? Eli's two sons died in battle. Remember Eli, when he heard the news, he fell back on his chair and cracked his head. When he heard the news, not of his sons dying, but of the Aram being taken. And the wife of one of these, the wife of Pinchas, was just giving birth to a child, and in childbirth, the mother died and named the child Ikavod. Ikavod. Okay, this Ikavod had children and children's children, right? Achimelech, right? Who started to make a foundation, not for a place like Shiloh, but a place where the Aron could be, because they got the Aron back from the Philistines, where they could put up the Lechem Aponim, and they could put up a menorah, right? That place became Nov, Nun Bet, Nov. It's a city in the heart of Israel, and that's where the Mishkan stood during the time of Shmuel. And the korbanos were brought there. And the Kohen Gadol at the time was a man named Achimelech. And Achimelech made the mistake of giving David some bread and a sword while David was in flight from Shaul. By no means did Achimelech mean to rebel against the king. He asked David what he's doing, and David said he's on a secret mission for the king. Achimelech had no reason to doubt him or to deny him. And he did help him. Okay, Doika Adomi Yimach Shemo. He said that David also inquired of God for the Urim V'Tumim. Now that's a problem. The Gemara in Yuma says that you can only inquire of a king for the Urim V'Tumim, or the Kohen Gadol. You can't just inquire for just anybody. Otherwise, everyone's going to go to the Kohen Gadol for the Urim V'Tumim and ask which horse is going to win and which stock should I buy. Everyone's going to start asking for stupid things. Only the king can ask the Urim V'Tumim, the colors of the Choshen, to spell out certain answers for questions. And if the Kohen Gadol did indeed inquire of the Urim V'Tumim for David, A, he would have known that David was lying, that he wasn't on a mission for the king. And B, if you're asking for David, that means treating him like a king. Shaul saw what he was told about what the Kohen Gadol did for David as rebellion, and Shaul killed all of the Kohanim of Nov. Okay. He killed 85 families of Kohanim. It was devastating. And one child survived. His name was Eviatar. Eviatar was a loyal follower of David, following the political advice, as David tells him, stay with me. Whoever wants to kill you wants to kill me. That should make us friends. The enemy of my enemy is my friend. Okay? So David and Eviatar had a good relationship. Eviatar served as David's Kohen Gadol. Right? He would ask Eviatar advice while he was in flight of Shaul. And Eviatar helped him. Okay? So Eviatar was a loyal servant of David, but he made the mistake after David died. Actually, it wasn't after David died. David was still alive. But he made the mistake of supporting Adoniyahu's bid for the throne. Thanks. So thirsty. Thanks. It's very hot in here. So Eviatar made the mistake of supporting Adoniyahu's bid for the throne. You may recognize this as the Haftorah of Parshas Chaye Sara. And when Eviatar supported Adoniyahu, that would have been all well and fine if Adoniyahu won out, but he didn't. David got wind through the help of Bathsheba and the prophet Nasan, and he got wind of Adoniyahu's plans. And while he was alive, David crowned Shlomo king. David died a commoner. And after Shlomo became king, he showed his displeasure with Eviatar's support of Adoniyahu. It's not like an election in a democracy where, you know, you have to be the president of everybody, whether they voted for you or not. Shlomo shows extreme displeasure to Eviatar when Shlomo becomes king. And Shlomo banishes Eviatar to a city called Anatot. And he tells him, you stay here because you're not ever going to serve in my temple. And then there's like an editor's note in Melachim. It says, this was to fulfill the promise that God made about the house of Eli, that they would never serve in the temple. So the temple's about to be built, and Eviatar is out. He's replaced by someone named Tzadok. Oh, good. Okay, so if Yirmiyahu is from Anatot, then it stands to reason that he was not of an important Kohanic family. And it's very interesting. If you take out the concordance and look up the word hashkem, like vayashkem, hashkem v'shaloach, look up the word hashkem. You all know what it means, right? It means to get up early in the morning, right? Okay. Yirmiyahu uses this word more often than all the other Nevi'im and Nevi'im Achronim combined, including Treyasar. It's not even close. Yirmiyahu begins many a prophecy speaking how he is Hashkem to tell Bnei Yisrael his message. Why do you think? He has to get up early in the morning to deliver his messages. Nu, why do you think? Because he lives in Anatot. Yes, Anatot is far from the places where God tells him to deliver the message, which is Jerusalem. Okay? Anatot today is an Arab village. All right, so it's if you have to deliver a message by lunchtime in Yerushalayim, you better get up early in Anatot in order to get there. So why not move to Yerushalayim? Well, Anatot is where he's from. He's a descendant of Eviatar. Right? You're right. Why would the Kohen want to live in Anatot? The Kohen wants to live closer to Yerushalayim. Okay, anyway, that is why he speaks about getting up so early. Incidentally, I meant to say in the beginning that this learning tonight is L'Zecha Nishmas Rav Nachum ben Harav Meir, Rav Nachum Michel, whose son dedicated this shir in his father's memory. And may his memory be a blessing. May all our learning be for Ilu Neshama Freya. Okay, so let's continue reading. Asher hayo dvar Hashem elav b'mei Yoshiyahu ben Amon melech Yehuda. His prophecy came during the reign of Yoshiyahu, the son of Amon, king of Yehuda. B'shlosh esrei shana l'malcho. Now that's a rarity. Usually the Tanakh does not tell us what year of a king the prophet began his prophecy. Why does Yirmiyahu care enough to tell you what year of Yoshiyahu he began delivering his message? The answer I suggest to you is because in the 18th year of Yoshiyahu, a cataclysmic event took place that involved the finding of an old Sefer Torah. I won't get into all the intricacies, but that took place in the 18th year of Yoshiyahu, which did spur, or was part of, I should say, a huge tshuva movement, culminating in a very large observance of Pesach, that we read as the Haftorah of the second day of Pesach. Okay? So what Yirmiyahu is saying is that his prophecy preceded that cataclysmic event. In fact, his prophecy may very well have precipitated that event. Right? The finding of the book did... I'm far from it. The finding of the book did not create the tshuva movement. It was a tshuva movement that had existed beforehand, and the finding of this book was part of that movement. Okay, incidentally, just if you know your Assyrian history, the 13th year of Yoshiyahu started his reign in the year 640 BCE, so the 13th year is 627 BCE. 627, Assyriologists know, was the last year that there was an Assyrian empire. The Assyrians overextended their borders and ceased to be a world power by 627. Which means that when Yirmiyahu was told to address his people, it was a time of opportunity. There was opportunity in the air. There's more freedom. With the fall of Assyria, means that we have more freedom of movement, more freedom to possibly call back some of the 10 tribes to return. Okay. That didn't happen here, but we were hoping it would happen later in the time of Ezra. Right? Vayibi me Yehoh Yakim Pasuk Yemo Ben Yosheo Melech Yehuda Atom Ashtey Esrei Shana Letzidkiyahu Ben Yosheo Melech Yehuda Adlos Yerushalayim B'Chodesh HaChamishi. He says he had 18 years during the reign of Yoshiyahu. From his 13th year, he ruled 31 years altogether. There were 11 years under Yehoiakim and 11 years under Tzidkiyahu. You could do the math. You gave prophecy for 40 years, like Moshe, until the whole nation went into exile in the fifth month, which is, of course, Tisha B'Av. Now, the koteret, the introduction of Yirmiyahu, these few psukim, omit two kings. It omits Yehoahaz, and it omits Yehoiachin. Why not count them? The answer is very simple. Those two kings ruled for very short times. Okay? Yehoahaz ruled only 3 months. Yehoiachin ruled, like it says in Devarim, 100 days. 3 months and 10 days. Okay. So the kings who rule short reigns are omitted from Yirmiyahu's koteret. By the way, he addresses both of these kings in the book by name. Okay? Okay. Hashem's first message to Yirmiyahu. Now, the Rambam says that what I'm about to read is true of every Navi, every single Navi who has ever lived is a fulfillment of what we're about to read now. So the question is, so why does Hashem only tell it to Yirmiyahu? V'yedivar Hashem elai lemor. Right? By the way, look at Pasuk Dalid, look at Pasuk Yud Aleph, look at Pasuk Yud Gimel, right? Notice that Yirmiyahu says very often, V'yedivar Hashem elai lemor. V'yedivar Hashem elai lemor. V'yedivar Hashem elai lemor. Perek Beis, V'yedivar Hashem elai lemor. Right? Perek Gimel, Pasuk Vav, V'yedivar Hashem elai. Gimel Yud Aleph, V'yemar Hashem Elai. Right? Who writes a book like this? Moshe. Dvarim. Okay? As opposed to Perek Zion, which begins, Hadvar Hashem Hayah El Yirmiyahu Meis Hashem Lemor. Right? There is a qualitative difference between Ve'emar Hashem Elai and Ve'edvar Hashem El Yirmiyahu, obviously. One is first person, one is third person. Okay? I will tell you this. We can't hide from it. The style of Yirmiyahu is similar to the style of Dvarim. That we should go from there to determine that Yirmiyahu wrote Dvarim is, well, it's heresy to Judaism, that's for sure. Yeah. Okay, but just because the style of two books are similar does not mean causation. It doesn't mean that this is a cause to say that one wrote the other. I don't mind saying that Yirmiyahu was aware of Sefer Devarim, realized that his agenda is quite similar in scope, right? A book that is very much attuned to reward and punishment, to convincing people to do better, and especially a hope to soon enter the promised land. In the case of Yirmiyahu, not so soon, but to return to the promised land after 70 years. So a lot of what Sefer Devarim has in mind as its agenda that sometimes sets it apart from similar passages and earlier in the Torah, like in Sefer Shmos or Sefer Bamidbar. So Yirmiyahu has a lot of those same agenda issues, most of which is to give tochacha. Notice, Divrei Yirmiyahu, Eila HaDvarim, you get it? Divrei, Dvarim, right? Dvarim is in the 40th year, Yirmiyahu gives Nevuah for 40 years. Of course, yeah, you're familiar with a song we sing in the Kinos on Tisha B'Av. It goes, na 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 na. And then we say softer, na 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 na. But say, see me, Rishalayim. So there's a contrast between when we left Egypt, going to Israel. Everything was joyous and everything was wonderful. And then somewhat, it's a very clever keynote. We usually sing it in our shul. And that the contrast of what happened to us, Nebuch, but say, see me, Rishalayim, when we left Egypt. When we left Jerusalem to go into exile. Okay? All right, so the thing that Hashem tells Yirmiyahu in Pasuk Hey is, B'terem yitzorcha ba'beten yidaticha, uv'terem teitzei merechem yitashticha navila goyim nisaticha. Before you were born, you were set aside. Before you were even conceived, you were set aside to be a navila goyim. Not just a Navi to deliver a message to many nations. Okay? And indeed, the very end of Yirmiyahu's book, he addresses a whole host of nations. He's not unique to this. Yeshayahu also addressed a lot of those nations. Amos starts his book by addressing six nations. And Yechezkel, in the middle of his book, also addresses a series of nations. So Yirmiyahu is not the only one, but Yirmiyahu is called Navi LaGoyim. Because that is the main focus of his prophecy. Okay? So why did Hashem have to tell him that I chose you from birth? From the moment of your conception, you were set aside to be a Navi. That's how your chromosomes were set up. Your whole life has been waiting for this. You were born for this. So the Rambam maintains that every Navi has to be born from the void. You can't just go to the Nevuah school and become one of the 48 Nevi'im in Tanakh. You can become contemplative. You can become spiritual. Right? But to be one of those 48 Nevi'im or 7 Nevi'ot, it's sort of predestined. Okay? So if that's the case, this is the Rambam. You could agree or disagree. If that's the case, why does Hashem only tell this to Yirmiyahu? Can anyone imagine the Rambam's answer? The Rambam himself asks this question and gives an answer in the Mor Nevuchim. If every Navi has to be picked from before, so why does Hashem only tell Yirmiyahu? The answer is...
He had a hard job.
So yes, it's a harder job. He had to be convinced to take this very hard job. That's definitely a good answer. It seems to be the Radak's answer, but it's not. The Rambam's answer is that Yirmiyahu was too young to understand this. Right? That Yirmiyahu needed convincing. So Hashem had to tell Yirmiyahu because Hashem knew that Yirmiyahu would object. Right? Perhaps because of what Dr. Goldfarb said, because it was a very difficult mission. This nation kills their prophets when they don't like what they say. I want to grow up. I'm just a Na'ar, right? You get it? I'm just a Na'ar. I have barely lived. I'm just a little kid. Give me some light. Let me live a little before they kill me. Right? So Yirmiyahu is this, because Hashem knew that Yirmiyahu would object, so he had to preempt him, to tell him, Yirmiyahu, you can't object, you were born for this. So then the Radak asks an obvious question. If Hashem is supposed to tell every Navi who would object before his first prophecy that you were chosen before your birth and there's no way you can disobey, why didn't Hashem tell that to Yonah? Or Moshe. Moshe also objected. Hence, this is the Haftorah of the story with Moshe at the burning bush, where he objects.
Maybe it was a different mission.
Because
what made them stronger Nevi'im was the fact that they didn't deliver the message either not right away or through somebody else. Like when you had Moshe, let's say, going, and you have Aaron speaking for him, then, you know, it looks like so, it spooks people. And then you have Yonah also, because he also spooked everybody by, you know, by what happened.
So, I mean, look, you can say that those missions were salvation missions, no doubt. And they had a much greater chance for success, although, you know, Moshe is not, Moshe standing up against a quite a powerful king. But Yirmiyahu's mission is, God, what's the upside for me? To get beaten? To get kicked at and spat at? To get put in the stocks and dungeons and be the object of derision for the entire nation?
Who of them was successful? Nobody. Nobody was successful. Besides maybe Moshe. Absolutely nobody. And after all the Nevi'im were thrown out, and up until now are not learned in general, and that's how it is.
Jacob, be careful with the absolutes. I was 100% successful.
There's no absolutes. I heard it from a very distinguished rabbi. It is not even my. I
get you, but here's the thing. Uh-huh. Tell me somebody else who was alive at the time of Yirmiyahu whose words are studied to the extent with which his are. I'm not even talking just by Jews. Yirmiyahu was profoundly revered by Christians too.
Right. Right. But it's much later. And the Jews...
Okay, but you're right. You know, that's ironic.
Yeah.
That's ironic. If Yeshayahu would come to the world today, every show in the world would be fighting over each other to have him the first scholar in residence at their place. But what good is that, considering that in his own time he was mocked, right?
Right.
That's what can I say? Sometimes it's in retrospect. Now the world is busy canceling everybody if they said one objectionable thing.
Right.
The opposite. The opposite is true of our prophets. They were canceled in their time, but with time, the truth of their message came out. Yirmiyahu with this very soon. But please, let's not make the mistake of thinking that Yirmiyahu's mission, as we're about to read it, was to save the kingdom and to save the nation and to save the palace and to save the temple and to save Jerusalem. No, that was never his mission. It was an impossible mission.
His mission was to stay in the land. They should give in to Babel.
Yes, so you can say he did not succeed in that because they did fight. Right? They carried off a lot of people with the exile of Jehoiachin in 597. And for the 11 remaining years, you know, he was begging them to surrender. The Babylonians are always at your door. And sometimes they appealed to the Egyptians for some help. You know, they had to pay confiscatory taxation and tribute to the Babylonians. Sitkiyahu stopped paying the tribute at some point, and the Babylonians saw that as rebellion, right? The rest you know. So if Yirmiyahu's mission was those five or six things I just mentioned, then he would be a miserable failure, right? But his mission was to assure that the Jews would surrender. He failed at that too. Because had they surrendered, then it's likely that a lot more Jews would have remained in Israel, who could have been hospitable to the Jews returning, you know, show them the ropes. Right? They could have been returning in Ezra's day to a large contingent of those who remained in Israel all those years, planting vineyards, growing crops. But one thing is for sure is that the later books of Tanakh, like Daniel, Zechariah, right, those books all make reference to Yirmiyahu by name as the one who promised the return. And they say now the time that he predicted is drawing near. Let's get ready. Okay. All right. So we have our answers. For the Rambam, the Radak's Kashas and the answers to the Radak's Kashas. Let's go on. But Omar, Aha Hashem Elokim. Hinei lo yadati daber ki nar anochi. Hashem Elai al tomar nar anochi ki akol asheret bachachot elech v'skol asheret tabechot tadaber. Hashem tells him, I want you to go to my people. And Yemiel says, but I don't know how to speak, God. This can mean a lot of things. If you want to take it into a deeper level than just I'm not a good speaker. What he could be meaning here is that I don't have a good standing with the people. I'm just a nom. Even if I had a good standing, this is not a simple message. I'm a nobody. Who am I supposed to talk to? I'm just going to push my way up to the podium in a shul and give a message. Could you imagine if you were commanded to run into Temple Emmanuel this Friday night? I do believe they have some services Friday night, and push your way to the podium, throw away the microphone because it's Shabbos, and start talking to them about the importance of keeping Shabbos kashrus and taharas mishpacha. Imagine how that's going to go. Yirmiyahu had no better mission, because Yirmiyahu had to, while being a na'ar and an unknown name, an unrecognized person, Yirmiyahu had to convince them to stop sacrificing children, for goodness sakes. You know, you think that would be an easy one. Right? Don't be afraid of them. Now, in the Tanakh, whenever Hashem has to tell someone, don't be afraid, I mean, this might be true in everyday life. What does it mean when someone tells you, don't be afraid?
You're already afraid.
You're already afraid. You have reason to be afraid. I'm just telling you not to be. Right? Alti Rav di Yaakov, because Yaakov is afraid. Right? So Hashem tells him, don't be afraid. Have courage. Stand up for what you believe in, because I'm behind you. God put forth his hand and stuck and touched my mouth. Now the same exact words appear in Yeshayahu's opening prophecy, which happens to be chapter 6 in his book, where it says an angel took a coal with a melkachayim, with like a tongs, and touched Yeshayahu's mouth with the coal, and said, now I have relinquished your iniquity, I have forgiven you of your sin, now go speak to my people. The obvious question is, the Torah uses the same three words, by Yaga, El, P. By Yaga, Al P. By, he touched my mouth with this thing. Right? So, in Yeshayahu, he touched the angel touched God, Yeshayahu with a hot coal. In Yirmiyahu, God touches his mouth directly, just as he touched his mouth. Okay? Why doesn't it say that your iniquity has been forgiven? So I have two answers. One is that Yirmiyahu was just a lad. He had no iniquity building up, as opposed to Yeshayahu, who may have been quite a bit older. Okay? So when you're older, you're bound to have some, need some kapara. Okay? Second explanation is that Yeshayahu had just disparaged his people. He said, oy vey, oy loyally kidded Macy, the staff Torah Parshas Yisro. Ki ish t'meis v'sayim anochi. I'm a man of impure lips, yet I saw God. Uvetoch am t'meis v'sayim anochi yoshev. My people don't deserve to have such a sighting, because I reside in the midst of wicked people. Okay. So, God was angry with Yeshayahu. said, you want to say that you don't deserve the prophecy? Fine. That's your business. But don't talk about your people not deserving a prophet. Who are you to say that? So God needed to touch Yeshayahu's mouth with a coal to atone for his guilt, something Yirmiyahu didn't need. So it just says God touched his mouth. Now in Pasuk Yud, God reveals to Yirmiyahu his mission statement. Follow with me, please. This, as well as any Pasuk in this entire book, encapsulates the mission of Yirmiyahu when he says, Re'eif kadaticha la yom hazeh ala goyim ala mamlechos, litosh v'lintot l'avid l'aros, four synonyms for destroying and demolishing, and at the end, livnot v'lintoa. Notice that the word livnot is the only verb here out of the six verbs that doesn't have a mod. Right? Livnot v'linto implies that this is the natural conclusion of all of this destruction. That it's destruction for the sake of rebuilding. The wall is so decrepit it has to be taken down in order to be built back. Okay. Said, what do you see, Yirmiyahu? And he said, I see a staff sprouting almonds. Now, why almonds? Why not peaches? Why not plums?
Almonds blossom fast.
Almonds blossom fast and hence have created a Hebrew word called lishkod. Yirmiyahu says later in the book, Eshkod is a verb in Hebrew, which means to do something surely and swiftly. Okay. So the Makel Shokade is a sign of things happening swiftly. The Assyrians have just been vanquished, and some very important changes can take place immediately. But you have to be ready for it. If not, that king called Nabopolassar up north in Babel, his son Nebuchadnezzar is going to become very strong. Okay. Rashi makes a remez that the shofet takes 3 weeks to sprout. So it's reminiscent of the Bein HaMetzarim, 2 weeks in the summer. That's a problematic shita because in Bayis Rishon, which is where Yirmiyahu lived, the siege was broken into on the 9th of Tammuz. We all know that the Beis Hamikdash was destroyed on the 9th of Av, but the 10th of Av, but more than 21 days later, right? Rashi says that the Shokade was chosen to represent this first prophecy because it takes 21 days to sprout. That's why we sing about the Shokev on Tu Bishvat. Alright, this is actually the third time God is talking to Yirmiyahu, but it's the second time with a vision. And this time he shows him again. I see a cauldron. It's not on fire. That would be a sir nofeach. A sir nafoach means a cauldron where the bellows are trying to blow the fire evenly under all of it. In other words, it's not being baked. It's not being cooked yet. It's not bubbling. Okay, the Gemara in Brachos says seeing a bubbling pot is a good sign. It's a sign of peace. And if this is a bubbling pot, then the message doesn't come out. Right? Okay. So Hashem says again, Vimar Hashem Eli, Nitzafon Tipatach Ra'al Kol Yoshvei Aretz, right? The cauldron has like a lip, like an opening, and that opening is facing north because all bad things in Israel happen from the north. Nitzafon Tipatach Ra'al. That's how Pasuk Yudalad begins. Al Kol Yoshvei Aretz, everybody, not just the Israelites. Yemer Hashem Elai, Mitzapon Tipatachara, I'll close. Kinini Kore, Lachomish Bachos, Mamachos, Tapon, and Numa Sham, who bob in the Smish, who saw Pesach Shari Yushalayim, but all Hamosel Saviva, call away Yehuda. It's as if though that the people who want to conquer Yushalayim, that no trouble doing so, no. They'll just put up a chair, set up shop. There's nothing you could do about it. I'm going to talk judgments with you, justice, after all of your avodah zarah, bowing down to the works of your own hands. Hashem tells Yirmiyahu, "Tezor mas nachav kamta b'dibarta aleihem is kol asher nochiyat tzebeka." Now gird your loins. That's a Bibleism. Ta'azor masnecha means get yourself ready. Kamta b'dibarta aleihem. Get up and speak to them. The end of this pasuk is a bit confounding. Okay, most English translations will read something like, "Do not be afraid before them, lest I cut you down before them." In other words, if you show fear, they will cut you down, and I'll let them. What about my promise to look after you? Yeah, but you have to show some kind of shtadlus. Right? Even when David was told that he's going to be the next king of Israel, he still looked for strategies of surviving Shaul. Right? He could have gone to Shaul and say, "Make my day. God promised me I'm going to be the next king, and I accept his promise, come what may." Right? Okay, so, however, I prefer Rav Yosef Kara's reading, which is, "Al techas mipneihem penachit chalifneihem." Do not fear that I would cut you down before them. That's what he said. It's a more appropriate message. Do not fear them, lest I cut you down. In other words, don't be afraid that I would cut you down. Pen is maybe a little awkward. Right? In English, we use it. Don't do this lest you come to harm. Okay? They'll try to get at you, but they will not, because I won't let them. Okay, that favors the Rabbi Yosef Kara's approach, or that don't be afraid lest I cut you down before them. I will never do such a thing. Okay. This is a very rare week where the Haftorah of one week goes right into the Haftorah of the next week. The next puzzle. Right? You finish at the end of Perek Aleph. The beginning of Perek Bet is the Haftorah for the week after, which we'll do in Mitzvah Hashem next time. Okay. If I have to get off a little early, there's a beautiful Emuna group that meets at 9 o'clock on Monday and Wednesday. Please look at your WhatsApp or your emails and look up how to get on. I'm doing the first class at 9 o'clock. The class tonight is an introduction on Tikva, Emuna, and Bitachon. We want to enhance our Emuna during 3 weeks, right? So that's going to be in just a few minutes. I'm going to be talking about Tikva, Emuna, and Bitachon. And then the rest of the time, we will be doing reading. You know, it's a women's group, by the way. Okay, I'm just giving tonight's share. All right, everybody. Thank you so much. Next week, we're doing the second of the 3 weeks. That will be Yirmiyahu chapter 2. Okay, everybody. Bye-bye.